Brett Dickerson. I've been through a lot of times in my life where I had to make decisions. Those decisions were not always the easiest. Well, I call those times intersections. I'm interested in those intersections that other people have had in their lives because I want to learn from that, and maybe you can too. I hope you enjoy today's podcast. Today I'm talking with Sandino Thompson. His firm is called Public Strategies, which is designed to be very flexible in helping clients from the private and public sector. Currently, their ongoing projects are focused on helping people to strengthen their families and find better ways to fortify marriages. Sandino grew up in Oklahoma City, moved away for some time, but just found that he couldn't stay away. He had to come back. I'm going to talk with him about the important intersections in his life where he had to make some big decisions. But first, we're going to hear Sandino talk about one of his big passions right now, maps for neighborhoods. Briefly tell us kind of your elevator pitch about maps for neighborhoods.
The idea with Maps for Neighborhoods is just that it's that we've built these places, we built places, but we want to think about spaces, and spaces consist of both the place and the people. So it's like, how do we bring this Maps brand to that next iteration where we can really also invest in the people who live here, not just the places that live here.
Right. So the Maps 3 is just about to sunset mm-hmm. in terms of the tax. So people are already talking about Maps 4. And it sounds like to me you guys are wanting to be a part of that Maps 4 conversation, right?
Yeah. And I think it's really that we want to contribute to the conversation. So, yes, we want to be a part of it. But I'm just real careful and cautious. I mean, I've been known both throughout my life to be somewhat of a rebel, and I definitely know how to instigate. But in this case, I mean, that's not the expectation. That's not the intention, right? So what we really want to do is contribute to the conversation. We feel like, I mean, all things being equal, over the past 20 years, this city's seen remarkable progress and remarkable growth. It has created a beacon almost for a lot of sons and daughters of Oklahoma City. And then a lot of those who've paid attention to what's going on, whether it be around other parts of the state or even other parts of the country. So people have really taken notice, right? So I don't want to discredit that. I don't want to undervalue or underplay that whatsoever. And I don't think this effort wants to do that either. So we really want to contribute to the conversation and give an opportunity. We care about the Maps brand, but we really care about what Maps has done for the city. So we want to take some responsibility as caretakers of what that is to sort of usher it in, you know, to whatever those next phases are.
But this idea sounds different mm-hmm. than the previous maps that were very, very much brick and mortar oriented. Yeah. Talk about that some.
So I think what we realize is that, so the first maps was really Oklahoma City's, was our opportunity to do something different, to change course, et cetera. So we planned some very interesting novel projects. Frankly, we probably planned some projects people just never really thought would work. I mean, so you think about the river, right? And that's just a pretty straight up infrastructure capital improvement type of project. We put dams on the river to sort of back up on what on the Corps of Engineers and some other things that had been done in the past to really we straightened that river out and made it a man-made sort of thoroughfare. And to deal with floods and things like that, which were a big issue of the time. But then, you know, it had the other effect of really disinvesting that riverfront. So if you go back and you look at the early history of the city, I mean, there were all these things happening. Yeah. So maps. So a lot of those maps programs is like, what are the things we can do to really set a vision? And it was focused on spaces. Focused on places. Oklahoma City has a pretty good track record if you look at, you know, bond and debt ratings, all those kind of things of doing that. We do places well. So those projects, I think, would really help to invigorate things. I mean, helped invigorate Bricktown with the canal. Obviously, the arena, I mean, with foresight makes us look brilliant because now we have a national basketball team that we never would have imagined. Me, never growing up in the 80s, never would have imagined having an NBA team in Oklahoma City. So Like I say, all the credit to those efforts, but they were capital improvements kind of focused on giving us a shot at getting ourselves together, pulling us up from the bootstraps. Now, with Maps for Kids, you had an investment in education, but what we said was we're going to create some of the best infrastructure in the country for education. And it's a brilliant idea. I think it definitely sets a great foundation to do something different because we know we have education is the core of the elements of stability in a community. So that was a great idea. So with Maps, with Maps 3, we looked at all this momentum that was built, the opportunity that exists. So we do have the thunder. We do have these opportunities. So we looked at, so what is that next step forward to really kind of bring this these assets and things together? So you had things like the streetcar, you know, a convention center to kind of really, in a park to really kind of put that crowning touch on downtown, but also things like parks and trails that we wanted to build out for quality of life. So all great infrastructure improvements. Now, if you think about, let's take Maps for Kids, for example. In Maps for Kids, we built these schools, which in a lot of instances, definitely in the neighborhoods I'm familiar with, some of the nicest facilities in the neighborhood, okay? But we still have the same sort of conditions. The families, the people who live there, and the people who don't live there, maybe sometimes just as important, are still having the challenges of functioning in those neighborhoods and engaging even with that infrastructure and those capital improvements, those schools that we built. So it's like, so at some point we have to think about the kids who are walking to school on grass trails because there aren't sidewalks to get them there. And that's more of a connectivity issue in those neighborhoods. You know, we have to think about the health and some of the other aspects of what goes into making a neighborhood. I mean, we have super high obesity rates, ridiculous mental health rates, the trauma. I mean, there's all kind of trauma and things that, from low-income neighborhoods that we have, low-income sort of underinvested communities. And this is sort of what I call the center of the city. Even we find these things, Capitol Hill, in the northeast side, that kind of thing. So there are these aspects that we're going to have to address. I think that, like I say, Oklahoma City has proven itself as a place that knows how to build infrastructure and do some of those things very well. We've got a great track record. We don't necessarily have that same track record in how we invest in the people aspect of things. So it seemed like it necessitated a different approach and maybe a more kind of community-based approach, because I really think that's the thing that's going to bring that people aspect into what this looks like, building a community for the people that live here.
If it succeeded, what would it look like?
So what we've talked about is the idea, if you just look at the sort of numbers for Maps, we've used a number of $500 million. It may be more or less than that, but if you're keeping consistent, we said, what if we used half of the MAPS funding? So we can still use another half of that funding to continue to invest in the more traditional capital improvement projects, mm-hmm. those big projects that we know about. So, but what if we use the other half to invest in this just idea of the MAPS for Neighborhoods concept? So that would mean roughly $500 million that we would invest in these kinds of ideas that really seek to raise up neighborhoods. So mm-hmm. we've talked about connectivity, culture, and health. Mm-hmm. So how do we weave those things in very practical and scalable ways? Mm-hmm. How do we weave those things in to improving quality of life, to improving community amenities, and tie in actually to downtown and to other parts of the community?
It sounds like you're talking about a process rather than a project.
Right.
You know, we've had projects like we're going to build the Bricktown Ballpark. Right. You know, that's a project. But it sounds like to me you're asking for a process. Is
yes.
that right?
You got it. I couldn't have said it better. So we are talking about a process that allows the communities and the neighborhoods, in a sense, to be empowered. So I don't think that we are seeing like Maps 4 as a silver bullet to solve every problem across the city. And we got one of the largest cities just as far as land mass in the country. So we don't want to be naive. We also don't want our contribution to be seen as unpalatable or unrealistic. But what we think is that we can definitely seed these ideas and then have the communities come up with through this process, they can come up with ideas. They can come up with concepts that they're behind that are tangible, real things. And we're and then we have the resources to invest in that.
Per neighborhood.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So each neighborhood, through the process, would come up with their own projects that they needed. Right?
Right.
Good. Okay. Well, what do you see as the roadblocks to achieving that right now?
I think that's a really interesting question. I think that the message and this effort that we have for transparency, I think in the past, I mean, to be frank, you know, the last MAPS initiative passed on one of the slimmest margins of the more recent efforts, you know, for things that go into public vote, whether it's bond issues or previous MAPS programs. So I do think for us, we're conscious of that. And so thinking about how we reinvigorate and get people feel like they're engaged. So I think there's the challenges are making sure that people understand that this is an effort to contribute to this process, to this decision-making process, to make an effort to propose to the city leaders, the city council, and others what we think is possible. But then also to the broader community, there are going to be a lot of people with a lot of ideas and a lot of priorities. And to get folks thinking about, we probably won't all get everything we want, but let's all be committed to moving this city forward sort of in a consistent direction. Let's agree on the principles and the approach and the process, and then let's support the efforts that come out of that.
So how would you go about training people? That's, you know, you're really calling for a training process here, aren't you?
Yeah.
First, so people just kind of know how to work with each other and something like that.
I think it's I like to think about it as we want to set the right expectation.
Right.
Okay. So when you talk about training, I mean, what I'm really wanting to do is when you engage with this process, we're setting an expectation and we're setting clear expectations across the board so that people know how to interact with what we're doing. They know what to expect and what not to expect. Right. And we think it's very important. I think a lot of times what happens is we don't want to share with the community the things that are hard to talk about. So we're doing, as a matter of fact, I think we've set up one of our first town hall meetings for the first Tuesday in October. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be at Ralph Ellison Library in the evening there. And what's critical for me is that we sit down in that conversation and say, here are the things we're going to do, but here are the things we aren't going to do. Here's why. Right. And so creating that expectation. And I think that will help people at least be clear. So you won't necessarily, again, like everything. I won't like everything that'll happen. But let's agree with this. Let's find this middle ground and agree that that's the thing that we can all stand together on to move the community forward.
Talk a little bit about how your family has intersected with some kind of pretty important history that a lot of people might know the larger history of.
Yeah, so we've actually had the fortune, especially, I mean, this is one of the beauties of technology, I mean, in this day and age. So in 2015, I can go and trace family roots and those kind of things in a way that a lot of times in the past, we had a big storytelling culture in my family. So we know the stories, right? But we it's hard to connect those dots. So we've been able to do a little bit of that. And it's really just kind of really invigorated this sense of history that we grew up hearing about. But my family on both sides, I mean, essentially we came to Oklahoma seeing it in some aspects with Native American tribes, and then in other aspects after Reconstruction, going back to the late 1800s. And so Oklahoma as a state and actually as a territory was a beacon at a certain point in the late 1800s, early 1900s for African Americans and others, because they saw it as a place of opportunity as lands were being opened up and that kind of thing, to get away from the South. Both sides of my family, a lot of family comes from Louisiana, places like that. And so we came to black towns initially in the eastern portion of Oklahoma, and then as the economy and things went early in the 19 teens and early in the history of Oklahoma City, that migration continued. And I had family come into Oklahoma City. On both sides, both my mother and father's family settled in Oklahoma City. We go, you know, back at least well, now I'd be the third generation, if not in some instances fourth generation, depending on how you look at it. And we just have really a long lineage in history. So, you know, I have family. I mean, my grandparents would tell me about the Great Depression. They were fans of Roosevelt in their minds with the work projects and that kind of stuff. Family who stayed. So I've got family, more distant family that moved to California. There's all these connections. So you read about like the Grapes of Wrath and all those kinds of things. Like it's that is my family story as well. Mm-hmm. And so, but also probably more similarly, like during the Civil Rights Movement. So both my parents went to Dungy High School. Dungy High School is named after Roscoe Dungy, he was an early sort of founding a member of the black community or the African American community in Oklahoma City. Came to Oklahoma City when it really first got started, not too long after the land run, established the first black newspaper, had I think upwards of 20,000 circulation, 20,000 people across the state and other places, was a president, a founding member of the NAACP. And so they grew up with this man, an individual, as an idea and as a con. I mean, they knew of him, but they also went to a school named after him, and were able to really connect that history.
Now that was in the midst, though, mm-hmm. of legal segregation.
Absolutely.
In Oklahoma.
Yeah.
After that long history of the tribes welcoming escaped slaves mm-hmm. versus then freed slaves mm-hmm. during Reconstruction, after that hopeful time period where they're right. all black towns
right.
formed, you talked about the Oklahoma that the Indian territories were a beacon.
Yeah.
A lot of those small newspapers in those all black towns were called the Beacon.
Yeah.
And so after that hopeful period, then all of a sudden, Senate Bill number 1 in the newly formed legislature establishes just straight up Southern style segregation in Oklahoma.
Yep.
So that becomes the backdrop for later protests in Oklahoma City, doesn't it?
Right.
That your family were a part of. Talk right. about that some.
So we have a pretty long history of protesting people who maybe have a different idea about Oklahoma being a place of hope and opportunity for different cultures. My father early on, so at Dungy High School, one of his teachers and one of the big influences in his life was Miss Clara Looper. So she taught at Dungy High School for several years, and he was in one of the first NCAA. I'm sorry, not NCAA, NAACP youth movements. So some of the first sit-in protests, lunch counters, and that kind of thing, lunch counter sit-ins. He participated in with several other. Pretty well-known individuals around Oklahoma City now. They went on to do great things.
Mm-hmm.
But and it's really a moving point. He went on to be an activist in a lot of different ways. One of my first memories, I actually saw an article of this back in 1983 when I was 4 years old, is a sign of me and the Oklahoman. We were protesting. I think we were demonstrating at Senator Don Nichols' office for them to approve the Martin Luther King holiday. Because at that time period, there was no acknowledged holiday. And so just a lot of movements. Both my parents went attended OSU, and there was a period of time of some racial sort of turmoil and things there. My father was involved with Dr. Earl Mitchell and some others in the response to that as well. And my mother actually was just a different history, but very much sort of interesting. I mean, we're that quintessential. She was the first person to go to college in her family, the first person to complete college in her family, and sort of set the tone. So I graduated from OSU as well. I've got at least two cousins that are my contemporaries graduated from OSU, and I've got about three or four nieces and nephews who are either in the process or on their way, and that's kind of the a history and lineage that's been there for us.
So segregation affected the East Side, certainly during segregation. That's you know, some I talked to quite a few new arrivals in Oklahoma City who just don't quite get the background of the east side of Oklahoma City. So segregation kind of cornered black people in what we call the east side of Oklahoma City now. So even after legal segregation is done away with, after this hard work that many leaders, some of your family members were a part of, how do you think, and this is kind of some broad strokes and it's speculation, but how do you see that segregation past still affects the east side of Oklahoma City when we're talking about development?
Well, so that's an excellent question, and it's something I actually thought a lot about, and it's got a lot of tie-in. So I'll try and be concise in my response. So let's start with Deep Deuce. Okay, so the early founding of Oklahoma City, one of the first things we did was pass Jim Crow laws, right. And that meant and one of those things that was expected was that the African Americans in the community would live essentially right north of Bricktown. So Bricktown at that time was a warehouse district, a huge rail yard that split Deep Deuce and Bricktown, and so it was considered the lowlands, that kind of thing. So that's where we could be. So in some ways, you know, segregation was actually a gift and a curse, because the gift of it, I'll say, now it was the unequal conditions and very much an expectation that we would be sort of second-class citizens, right? But the gift of it was that we had to depend on each other. The doctors, the dentists, the lawyers, the teachers, and everybody else in that community, side by side, we depended on each other. So what you had in Deep Deuce, I mean, this is something that's been written about for ages. I mean, it really does connect with even in Tulsa with Black Wall Street there in Greenwood. But what you had was this very vibrant community with all kinds of culture and strength. So that exists for several decades. I mean, as just a hotbed, we had, Count Basie and all these folks that we know all kinds of things
Jimmy
about
Russian.
Coming here. Jimmy Russian, right. As an Oklahoman, Charlie, yeah. Christian. Yeah. I mean, a trendsetter in the electric guitar, right? So we brought that up. Ralph Ellison, one of the great literary minds of the 20th century, right. Spoke eloquently in volumes about this area. So now we fast forward, right, and over the, I think, and really post-World War II, as we think about both the segregation movement but also the desegregation movement and the impact that both of those things had on the community. So over a period of time, the African-American community, through some lawsuits and some activism and action, it grew, but it was still very much segregated east of Lincoln and really in some ways is Deep Deuce and then kind of east of Lottie, you know? And so that's where our community grew and established itself as whites and others moved out of those communities. So we have this very strong sense of community that we've developed because, I shouldn't say because, in part because due to segregation. But then you have, you know, in the 60s and in the 70s, in the midst of this civil rights turmoil and sort of some of the post-circumstances of the civil rights movement at its core, you have a whole nother set of circumstances with urban renewal and other expectations. Things like redlining that people assumed were happening at the time, we know now for a fact that they took place. So
now let's stop there. Yeah. And just for our listeners who might not know, redlining was a practice that banks engaged in, mm-hmm. where they actually had a map in the back room, right. with a red line drawn around neighborhoods, and the loan officers were not supposed to loan money to black people to buy homes outside of that redlined,
right.
area.
Right.
Cities across the United States states engaged in it, and now there's research showing that even the FHA, the federal government, actually promoted that also quietly,
yeah.
in some cases secretly, but that was just a common banking, mm-hmm. practice. It was just for bankers. It was just what
it's
you taught,
yep.
taught the young bankers, yep. coming in. Yep. There's the map. Go in the back room. Look at the map. This is the way we do things, yep. here. So that's what redlining,
right.
is. Now go ahead with, yep. what you were talking now about the impact of all of, yep. that on the east side of Oklahoma City.
Right.
To today,
right. So how? So what? So the impact of those things, very much those sort of systematic things. So when we start talking about infrastructure, in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, infrastructure was used actually to sort of divide to further divide, if you will, the African-American community, the East Side, traditionally African-American community. So we put a giant freeway, I-235, through Deep Deuce, essentially, which was still at that time, prior to that, the heart. I mean, people think about the heart of the East Side as 23rd Martin Luther King, but it was, in fact, still Deep Deuce. If you go back to the 60s and 70s, there are these ups and down cycles and what was going on, but that was still the heart and the pulse of our community. So we essentially put a freeway through the middle of it, cut it in half. We have urban renewal policies and these sort of redlining policies that really started to empty out certain sections of this community. And so what that also did was kind of empty out the visibility and the presence of our culture in those communities. So we have this very deep culture in Deep Deuce. If you look at Deep Deuce today, I mean, it's one of the most built out urban communities in Oklahoma City, but it doesn't look like us. It doesn't communicate the fabric. So we have plaques and things of that nature, but very few African-American-owned businesses or African-American-owned property. Now, that is what it is. But understanding that that's the history, we actually, our cultural heart has, in a sense, been either taken or given away. So you get to now today, when you start talking about the pride and those kind of things in education, some of the challenges. So along with that, you have I-35, I mean, a major thoroughfare, runs from Mexico to Canada, was also, I mean, if you see the way that I-35 works, it comes straight up at the river, essentially to downtown. It links with 235. Well, at the time it was built, it curved around, and where it went north was, again, literally straight through the heart of a very prestigious and very very tightly woven African-American community, the Edwards community, which was founded by a family, the Edwards family, who had started out in the junk business. And by the time it was all said and done, they had built one of the first African-American hospitals in this part of the country, right? So started out in the junk business. It built that up to own businesses, started the Edwards Development, that subdivision, and then built a hospital there that was really renowned in the region for being one of the first places African-Americans could go without any, without risk of being, you know, discriminated against, et cetera, for medical care. And so we put a freeway, I mean, literally through it. On one side is where the former hospital site was. On the other side is where the community started, right? So we had infrastructure used to sort of do those things. If you go through 4th Street, which is a thoroughfare into the northeast side, if you go down 10th Street and if you go down 23rd Street, so 23rd Street was a main street, but 4th and 10th, that's where people lived. You go down there now, you see lots of empty spaces, right? And that is a result of a lot of these actions. So when we start talking about the disinvestment or underinvestment in the community, and when you start talking about the conditions, the present conditions of the community, low income, low poverty, well, even African-American families seeing all of this, when they got the opportunity, they moved out, the ones who could. So we ended up with folks who couldn't move out or wouldn't move out. And it just creates a very different dynamic from that dynamic where I have the lawyers, the doctors, the teachers, and everybody else in society all living side by side in that sense of community. So it's really kind of, I mean, in the 80s and the 90s, it's just been a challenge. And it's a challenge that I think we have to acknowledge and understand and not just assume that, well, folks chose this for themselves or they somehow created this for themselves. No, I mean, we definitely have some responsibility in what takes place and how we treat our community and the places we live and the places we're from. But it's a combined effort. So what we say now in 2015 is also a combined effort to pull us out of that and to sort of reinvigorate and renew, truly renew that past and bring it forward into a positive future.
So this really is a major intersection for the people who still live on the east side of Oklahoma City right now, isn't it? Because we've already seen this development in Deep Deuce where it's this big apartment complex. Mm-hmm. It saved a couple of buildings, maybe about three or four buildings down there. And, you know, kind of for old time's sake, it's kind of classy looking buildings down there. The Haywood building I'm thinking mm-hmm. about and yeah. some buildings like that.
Little Page building there.
Yeah, yeah, right, there. Right. But what happened was development. Mm-hmm. And the development just kind of tips its hat a little bit to the history, and that's about the size of it. Do you see that as a negative potential for the rest of the East Side, just completely redeveloping without considering the people who yeah. are living there right now?
Well, we don't even think it's an option. I mean, I would say I think it's, for me it's important to highlight the folks who live there and who are there, but also the folks who are invested there. Because right. so there are two different dynamics. I mean, there are people who move to other places, and there are people who have kind of maybe lived more on the fringes and that kind of thing, but because of those circumstances. A JFK neighborhood is a very good example. So there was, so that a lot of the effort there, I remember in the 80s, my grandparents actually had moved there, built a house in the 80s, and it seemed like that development, and there was these blocks of new houses being built in the late 70s and 80s, and then it just stopped. And I think, and it seems like we never really figured out what that was about. You have all this empty land, but that development just kind of stopped. So at some point, we had new leadership with urban renewal, some new emphasis from the city and some other folks, and started investing in that community, building new houses, that kind of thing. So now you have a very pretty impressive mixed income sort of neighborhood there, where you have, you know, $150,000, $120,000 houses next to $300,000 houses. And I mean, that neighborhood has become denser and denser and really built up over time. What that demonstrated, well, there were all kinds of people who were just waiting for an opportunity
right.
to move back or to move in because they wanted to be there but just didn't see it, right? And so even my own story, I mean, at a point, I mean, I moved after I graduated. I didn't think I could find the opportunity. I was very ambitious. Didn't think I could find the opportunity at the time in Oklahoma City. The mentality and my expectations, it just wasn't there. You know, and I will tell you, so you talk about crossroads, at a point of being in Florida, spending some time in Texas, but always paying attention, this is always home, so always paying attention and seeing what was going on, but being in these other places trying to sort of make that life, right, make that career, at a point I just decided, I've got, there are things happening, there are things going on, and we have to be a part of what's next for Oklahoma City. We have to be a part of this renaissance that's taking place in this story. And that's a big part of what brought me back to Oklahoma City 5 years ago. And it's a big part of what the energy and the desire that exists on that part of town is. We want to be a part of that.
What could you have done instead of coming back? There. You had choices in yeah. front. I'm hearing a story about choices. All of the intersections we go through in our lives have all these different choices, and unfortunately, you know, there's kind of a saying about the why in the road. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. life would only be so fortunate if we only had a binary solution.
Right.
You know, one
right.
like zeros and ones. You know, yeah. just one or the other. But most of the time, it's a big intersection with a bunch of different streets coming into it, and you have a lot of different choices. What other choices did you have, and how did you make that? You know, you've talked a little bit here, but it sounds like there was really something drawing you back to Oklahoma City.
So, I'll ask you to help me keep that thought, because you asked a couple of things, mm-hmm. and I think they're very salient points. So I'll start with the choices. So I had the privilege. I'm very much a product of Oklahoma City. Spent a lot of time in Oklahoma City public schools. I got into a little bit of trouble. So at a point, there were a couple of years, my parents moved us to Edmond. Largely in part of me, and I appreciate them for that. Then we ultimately moved to Arcadia, which was another one of those historically black towns, mm-hmm. but very connected to the part of Oklahoma City that we grew up in as well, the far eastern part. Attended Oklahoma City Public Schools a good portion of my time. Had the fortune to spend a few years at Bishop McGinnis High School, which is probably the largest private school, but very diverse private school. And then, but actually ended up graduating from Emerson High School, which is an alternative education center in Oklahoma City. And so a very diverse experience, very diverse background. Grew up in Green Pastures, Dungy Park. My father had an office from as long as I can remember, right on 13th and Martin Luther King. So very much all that history. So I'm a product of Oklahoma City. Also had the benefit of going and getting a very low-cost, high-quality education at Oklahoma State University. Got a degree in engineering and was pretty clear about what I wanted to do. I had the fortune to work for a company that was in a growth mode. But all that time, in the back of my head, I've had the privilege, I've had a passport since I was a teenager, had the privilege of traveling all over the world. And what I realized is I was always an Oklahoman, you know? And so I was always an Oklahoman. I told you that history earlier about, you know, how, where we came from. Oklahoma was our land of hope and opportunity. My family came here. We've got Thompsons and Burkhalters, the two sides of my families, in eastern Oklahoma to this day. And we've been in Oklahoma City for three generations. And what I realized is, like, there are all these great things happening in the world. It was like, so I can just sit in those places and kind of let it pass me by, or I can actually try and bring those things back to the place that's home for me and to the place that I know. So 5 years ago, that was kind of the choice that I made.
So you come back to Oklahoma City, mm-hmm. because mostly because of your family history?
It was a lot because of family history. Again, to tie back to some of the things we were speaking about earlier, but it was also because I saw what was taking place. I mean, so when I left, I didn't want to leave Oklahoma. Initially, the first couple of years, I worked in Tulsa, as that was the best job opportunity I could find that was close. Had a couple of offers in Dallas, and I was like, yeah, Tulsa's close. But then it was like, to really do the things I wanted, I had to get out of state. And I'm looking at what's going on, and it's like, I mean, this is my home. It's a good place, quality people. We have this unique kind of relationships and way that we operate. But I owe it to my family and to the people who've invested to me to be the best I can be, to do the most I can. So I got to get out of state. But then I had the opportunity to watch the investment, right? And to pay, and engage with that a bit. I mean, I was here on a very consistent basis to engage with that a bit. And then I'm seeing my family, right? And seeing the need or the opportunity for us to be a part of what happens, to be a part of the success. And it's just like, yeah, this is what, if I am really going to be the change that I want to see in the world, and if I'm going to sort of take responsibility for this history, this lineage, this legacy that has been brought to me, I need to be here, and I need to engage with it, and I need to interact with it.
So you choose the street in that intersection that takes you back to Oklahoma City, yeah. And you bring with you a deep family history, which find that people from other cultures outside of Black American culture are surprised that your family has that deep of an history in Oklahoma and really feels that way about the land of Oklahoma?
Yeah, it's actually interesting. So even when I was at OSU, but definitely as I went out in the world, I'd meet people from New York, you know, from Louisiana, from Michigan, you know, just California, different places. And it wasn't a culture unique to myself, but it was something they heard. I mean, it's like, yeah, you Oklahomans, like, you guys are sure proud of where you're from, which is interesting because, like, we don't think it's like, I'm fine with coming to OSU, you know, getting a degree. There were a lot of folks who came here through the military, right? So they were caught, and that's how they ended up at OSU.
Right.
And it was like, yeah, you guys really think a lot of yourself. And it was like, and it's like, I actually accept that Oklahoma is what it is. You know, we're not Texas. We're not some of these other places.
Not Louisiana.
I don't want to be those other places,
right.
Frankly.
Right.
But what we are, I mean, there are a lot of folks here. So we have this Native American aspect, which one of my grandmothers is 50% Cherokee. You know, we have a lot of familial connections. In fact, some of my family actually came to Oklahoma with the Seminole Nation and some others. So we have that Native American aspect of them being through the history of this country, sort of brought here, right, and having to make their way here. But then we have all these other people, and I think there's something very unique about that aspect of our culture. Everybody who has a history that ties back to the early parts of Oklahoma, we came here because it was something. You know, folks came here because it was a reason to be. So, and it's even different from like the migration from like east to west, right, or the idea of the 13 colonies, that kind of thing, mm-hmm, for the founding of the, mm-hmm, of the nation. Because this was really that next iteration. It was like you could be no one. I mean, you could be a single mom whose husband had died, a widow or whatever the case, mm-hmm, was. And in that time period, that meant something. That meant a challenging life for you. You could come to Oklahoma, own a piece of land, and make your own way. So that history is kind of what is what's really unique, even for my family.
As a black person, you could do that. Yeah. Do you find that people outside of black culture kind of tend to either say, oh, you know, you're so mistreated, mm-hmm, you know, you poor black people. Yeah. And they kind of get stuck in that part of black history there, and do you find people kind of forget about the part of black history where black people come out of the Civil War, right, and start investing, yeah, claiming land, building stores, running newspapers, building school? Do you find people kind of tend to ignore that or forget that some?
I think human nature, we have a tendency to respond to things with a level of empathy, which is, mm-hmm, good. But when we don't have that real understanding and consciousness, mm-hmm, of it, then we tend to simplify, you know, our perspective with that empathy. So it's like, oh yeah, that was bad. And in some senses, people are like, yeah, it was bad, but it's in the past. Like, you know, let's kind of be able to move forward because we don't like it. It's uncomfortable, right? Yeah. So then in another aspect, you have folks who are saying, yeah, we acknowledge that and we need to fix this, you know, like we need to fix it. So we get these savior syndromes where you guys have been so disadvantaged, you had so many challenges, we're gonna come and fix this problem. But you're
still the victim.
Right, absolutely.
You're the victim in, right, one kind of thinking, yeah, you're still the victim, absolutely, in the other kind of thinking.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah, and what we wanna say at this point, at least what I want to say, I can't speak for everyone, but what I want to say and what I see is we don't want to be the victim because that's not even what I know. So I know the Roscoe Dungies and folks, they came here, sued the pants off the city for their illegal ordinances, took cases to federal court and all those things. Mm-hmm. So I know how to fight. But I also know how to work with this community. So you go back to Miss Clara Looper and the sit-in movement. And so you can contrast our sit-in movement here from Alabama, right, and Tennessee and some other places. So you didn't see dogs in the street. Right. You didn't see police batons beating the bloody hell out of people for exercising their rights, for protesting peacefully. What you saw was us saying we have a problem. We're not going to let it go away. We're going to do something about it. We want you to do something with us, right? So we could engage because that's the kind of, I mean, that history, people came here because this was the place where they could make their lives.
What you're, you know, the picture you're painting here is a picture of a city that has a history of engagement, mm-hmm, even when they might not want to, you know, even when this was uncomfortable. Right. There might have even been black people that said during that sanitation strike that could have exploded the whole city in violence, and it didn't, mm-hmm, because everybody kept talking to each other. I'm certain that there were black people in the community who said, "Oh my gosh, we don't need to be doing this. Mm-hmm. This is gonna tear everything up." Yeah. And certainly white people are going, "Well, how come we're doing all of this?" But we have a history of talking to each other.
Absolutely.
And does that loop back to your Maps 4 idea?
It absolutely does. So to take that sit-in experience, because I think it really is informative and instructive. So if you think about Oklahoma City, it's like early in the history, I mean, we were here, we have that common sort of the common culture on why we got here. But you think about the sit-in movement, the civil rights in the 50s and 60s, that action here, and it was tense, you know, and it was serious, right? And people were prepared to fight. Don't get me wrong. I mean, without a doubt. And in some instances, I mean, we did push back. Mm-hmm. But I also think that, you know, we did have that space to talk. So I'll give you an example. What happened with the sit-in movement, and this isn't something that gets maybe talked about as much, but this is why I think it's important to acknowledge the past and let it help us inform the future, is what happened in that sit-in movement is because we were communicating and we engaged, right? So it was very much an African American issue and an African American response, but you had through engagement white people in the city, white kids who joined that sit-in movement. And we don't really talk about that, but I've got a chance to talk to some of them because of my father's experience and others' experience. Mm-hmm. But and it started with one or two who they came to the meetings. They got to know the African-American kids who were a part of that movement. They got to know each other. And it wasn't a deal where, you know, oh, we're going to all act like we're the same because we're diverse, right? Sure. We do have different backgrounds. But it was acknowledging those different backgrounds. They got to understand each other and said, these folks kind of want the same thing I want. They actually have a lot of the same values I have. Well, if they can't sit at that lunch counter, I don't want to sit there either. Right? And so that, so now fast forward to 2015, you have myself, Kamal Pennington, others from the Northeast side, and we're engaging with a lot of folks who live in, you know, the Midtown, Uptown area, Gatewood, Crestwood, those areas. And in addition to other parts of the city, you know, the South Side, you know, and the North Side, and the 10th Street Western corridor, we're all sitting around the table and saying, "Hey, how do we move this city forward?" I'm not gonna assume that that I know everything about why you're doing what you're doing and who you are, and you're not gonna assume that you know everything about why I'm doing what I'm doing and who I am. But let's all agree that we want to be able to engage with each other's culture. We want to appreciate and value what we have going on. So we want the white and the Asian and the Latino community to come and engage with the African American community.
You're right? Talking about a process.
Absolutely.
You're talking about a process, which is harder. But the potential for achievement is just amazing.
Yeah. And there are a few better places, I would argue, throughout this country than Oklahoma City for that kind of experiment to be endeavored and for a group of people to feel like and come together around that kind of future. There are a few better places because of that history that we have and because of how we got here. There are a few better places for us to try this.
That concludes the interview. Thank you for listening. This podcast idea came from taking a hard look at the many intersections in my life and listening to the intersections that other people talk about in their own lives. I want to hear about your intersections. My email address is ideas@intersectionsok.com. You can also communicate with me on Twitter and Instagram @intersectionsok. Also, take a look at the website at intersectionsok.com. Steven Tyler is the producer, and I am your host, Brett Dickerson.